Welcome, everyone, and thank you all for tuning in to our third Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar of the fiscal year. My name is Erica Wire, and I work with Superfund Redevelopment here at EPA headquarters, and I am really glad you've joined us today as we discuss how Superfund Redevelopment can provide an opportunity for communities to pursue local public services needs and priorities. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI, hosts these webinars as part of a quarterly webinar series about the reuse of Superfund sites. SRI webinars share site reuse success stories as well as challenges, with the hope that these stories will inspire you to consider reuse on other blighted properties. Each webinar provides guidance, tools, and lessons learned to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. So here's what we'll be covering today. First, I'm going to share a little bit about SRI before we begin our discussion of our site-specific examples and planning tools. Our webinar today is centered on the successful public service-related redevelopment at Superfund sites. And then first, we'll hear from Joe LeMay, the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Coordinator for Region 1, about the history and redevelopment of the IndustryPlex Superfund site. Joe will discuss the transformation of the former chemical mining manufacturing site in Woburn, Massachusetts, into a public transportation center and other amenities. Then we will hear from Helen Botcher from Region 10 and Perry Barrett from the Bainbridge Island Metro Park and Recreation District about the history and redevelopment of the Wyckoff Company Eagle Harbor site. Helen will discuss the site cleanup and redevelopment of the site as the Bainbridge Island Japanese American Exclusion Memorial. And finally, we will hear from Mark Lewis with the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection and Kathy Castagna with Region 1 about EPA's development of the prepared workbook and how using the workbook can move sites towards redevelopment. And their presentation will share common questions, issues, and concerns addressed by the workbook. So the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI, works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. EPA's primary mission is to protect human health and the environment, and returning contaminated sites to productive use supports that mission. Reuse is a priority for EPA and an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals. It is important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there's no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate. Contaminated sites, like those we will talk about today, pose unique challenges in terms of both cleanup and reuse. However, they can also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. There are many excellent examples of site reuse from all over the country, everything from pollinator habitats to homes and shopping centers. And I would really encourage you to visit the SRI website to find more in-depth information. You can find the link to the SRI website here on the slide and also listed in your resources pod on the right side of your screen. I also really encourage you to visit the Redevelopment Partnerships page of the SRI website to learn more about the specific organizations that have partnered with SRI to assist us in Superfund site reuse. Collaborating with these organizations helps SRI provide appropriate tools and resources to turn reuse visions and plans into reality. SRI currently has partnerships with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Trust for Public Land and Pollinator Partnership, and these organizations are familiar with Superfund and willing to work with communities to explore reuse opportunities and available resources for their local Superfund sites. One final note, please feel free to ask questions of our presenters. We will try to answer questions after each section, but we may hold some questions if we think future presenters will address them. We will also have some time at the end, after all of the presenters, for any remaining questions. And with that, Joe is going to kick off our discussion of reusing contaminated sites to pursue local public service priorities with an introduction to the IndustryPlex site.
Thank you, Erica. My name is Joseph LeMay. I'm EPA's project manager for the IndustryPlex Superfund site. I'll be highlighting key aspects of successful reuse at the IndustryPlex site. My presentation will be an informative presentation where I have inserted various blue links in slides, throughout the slides, that will pop up specific relevant documents that you may be interested in receiving. At the conclusion of my talk, we will hopefully have time for some question and answers. The presentation today is primarily from my perspective as a project manager for over 20 years at the site. However, it's very important for me to note that the degree of success that has been achieved at the Industrial Park site is directly related to the cooperation and commitment of numerous stakeholders. Okay, so the Industrial Park Superfund site is located in Woburn, Massachusetts. It is, or was originally, a 245-acre site, approximately 10 miles north of Boston. It has a very unique location. It's adjacent to Interstate I-93 that runs north to south to the site, as well as next to Interstate I-95 that runs east to west, south of the site. It also has an active commuter rail service that runs through the site, and this is the railroad tracks here running north to south. So in real estate end of things, it's always location, 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 and Industrial Plex has an ideal location for reuse, giving its proximity to Boston. The site had served as a chemical and glue manufacturing facility for over 110 years. Initially from the 1850s to 1929, it was chemical manufacturing, primarily producing sulfuric acid, among other things, and then glue manufacturing until 1969. Development came in the 1970s and 80s, and unfortunately began disturbing these animal hide piles that were in the center of the site so that they could find and place their roadway for future use. It created numerous odor issues that not only affected the town but all surrounding towns, which eventually led to numerous lawsuits from these towns that got greater attention to the area, and it became listed on the Superfund list in 1983. These odors were known as the Woburn odors. I lived just north of Woburn, and when my family would drive through or along Interstate 93, every time that we would drive through Woburn, we were told by my parents to roll up the window. So it was the roll 'em up area. A former community activist by the name of Jack Marlowe identified this area as a moonscape between the 60s and 80s. You can see from the photographs that's on this slide that it was a rather barren area in 1993 with manufacturing. There were also arsenic pits. There was waste oil piles. There was many hide piles, rather barren. So through those years of chemical and glue manufacturing, we have significant soils and sediment contamination with arsenic, lead, chromium, among other metals. There's also groundwater contamination at the site, arsenic, ammonia, benzene, toluene. As a result of the glue manufacturing operations and redevelopment, there were four hide piles that were finally located at the site, two to the north, and east and the west and east hide pile, a large east central hide pile, a southern hide pile. Again, this is I-93 going north to south to the east side of the site, and to the south you have Interstate 95. There's the Abajona River that had run through the Industrialplex Superfund site, and through development had been rechannelized along commercial roadway, eventually forming the Abajona River that would flow through a southern site, another Superfund site in Woburn known as the Wells G&H site, and they're hydrologically connected with the river. The town is, and the community were significantly engaged in this area. Historically, we have contaminated groundwater that was distributed within the town in the 60s, 70s. Led to leukemia and death of children that was captured in Jonathan Haar's book, A Civil Action, and the movie A Civil Action. So the community is well engaged with the historical tragedies associated with the Wells G&H site and dealing with the environmental matters associated with two Superfund sites. So the remedy, this is a 86 cleanup decision. The blue highlight here is you can actually get a copy of the record of decision. Primarily what we have is a cap, a permeable cap in green that covers approximately 105 acres. Where is my arrow again? There it is. Sorry, I'm a little bit of a rookie at this here. So the green illustrates the locations for the permeable cap. The red area here is a part of the air remedy, which is an impermeable cap and gas collection treatment system over one of the animal hide piles. And the remedy also requires institutional controls. The types of covers that are in place, which was unique for this site at the time, was there was either an engineered cover that was typically 16 inches with the geotextile fabric separating clean from dirty soils, or we recognized existing buildings, concrete floors and foundations, parking lots, roadways as preventing contact to contaminated soils underneath. So the remedy was unique where we ended up having this developer that I was mentioning moving animal hides as they were building a road called Atlantic Avenue. And they created the four hide piles and all these odor releases. This developer actually donated his land to satisfy the Superfund liability. And by doing that, the developer's name was Mark Phillips Trust, which is called MPT. As part of the settlers, it included the trust, the chemical and goo manufacturing facilities, the property owners and the municipalities. And an interesting part of the consent decree was that it had created a mechanism for selling the donated Mark Phillips Trust land. And it created two trusts under the consent decree. The first one was the Remedial Trust. That was to fund the cleanup of the Superfund site. And the second was the Custodial Trust. And the Custodial Trust was actually more of a real estate trust. They had the obligations of holding and managing and selling the donated land, complying with institutional controls, providing access and subdividing the donated land, locating purchasers, negotiating and selling and conveying property, distributing the proceeds from the sales to the beneficiary, and this is a very important component of the consent decree that I'll get to next. And then if there was any unsaleable land that they would be placed in a long-term trust. A copy of the CD can be recovered with this link that I've attached at the end of the slide. So this is a very unique situation where, actually I'm going to go back one slide. I wanted to point out to you that the Mark Phillips Trust property was primarily located up against I-93 to the eastern side of the site. And this is actually a 1992 figure from the remedial design that envisions this area being subdivided and redeveloped. So it was actually incorporated into the remedy. There was discussions early on about a potential transportation center being located on the site, as well as a new interchange. All that was captured in the remedy. The consent decree through this beneficiary of selling the land and distributing the sales, which you can see down below in my slide here, the beneficiaries were the settling defendants of the remedial trust, and the sales of land, if they were up to $8 million, the settlers ended up getting 89% of that. The EPA would get 11%, and that would be held in an escrow account. And then it would be a sliding scale from that, where 8 to 10 million, it would be 50-50 between EPA and the settlers. And if the sales exceeded over 10 million, the agency would get 70%. The settling defendants would get 30%. Now, that actually forged a very strong partnership among all the parties. Included the custodial trust, the remedial trust, the settlers, the municipality, who was actually a component of the distribution of these sales, with them being paid for historical back taxes that were not paid. The custodial trust maintained a very strong, steadfast reuse vision that we all had agreed on, and that was improving infrastructure and access to enhance attraction and value. They also attracted and led negotiations with state transportation agencies and high-end users. And so through the custodial trust vision of improving access and infrastructure, they were able to help formulate these three public infrastructure improvements: the multimodal transportation center, called the Anderson Regional Transportation Center, which I'll get to a little bit later, a new interchange off of I-93, and a Commerce Way extension. All those were to provide greater access to other private properties that they would sell that were associated with the donated land. The private investment that they were targeting with the donated land was Dayton Hudson for Target Stores and another developer, a local developer, National Development, which ended up having Raytheon's headquarters, residence in Marriott, Boston Sports and Sports Club, among others. They also aided in securing public grants for infrastructure improvements, for example, extending a roadway up through the town with the city of, with the municipality. The custodial trust did a phenomenal job with all this work. They coordinated with the remedial trust, EPA, and the state regarding challenging issues such as loan approvals for remedial trust for funding a preliminary design for a new interchange, final sales prices on properties. The state transportation agencies were able to get legislative approval for a $20 million bond for building a transportation center. All these aspects were very important and led to the private sales of over $16 million at the site as of 2000. Okay, so EPA had its role with making sure safely incorporated the reuse and cleanup at the same time. Building Superfund liability was an issue. We ended up helping resolve that issue by establishing various prospective purchaser agreements. I've attached various links to those prospective purchaser agreements below, and including the State Transportation Agency, Dayton Hudson, and Metro North, which was a national development. We helped resolve property disputes. There were some issues, for example, with one property where the Future Transportation Agency was going to be sited, and we helped resolve that with the parties under the Superfund process. We were also very flexible with the remedy design, incorporating alternative caps to accommodate other reuses and adjusting our schedules to accommodate property sale and reuse. So in some cases, for example, the Regional Transportation Center was the last component of the remedy that was implemented at Industrialplex, and we incorporated the remedy surrounding that entire area first and saved that for last. So since January 11, 2002, the Brownfield Bill has been in effect, and now the agency doesn't require negotiating prospective purchase agreements with EPA any longer. The Brownfield Bill helps satisfy liability by the prospective purchasers becoming bona fide prospective purchasers. And I've attached a couple of links to the Brownfield Bill and Superfund redevelopment initiatives for information that you might be interested in. So the municipality and the remedial trust, they all supported this reuse and this vision. The town clearly was going to be providing some greater use in future tax rolls for the municipality. They were flexible and helped accommodating any zoning changes. They were able to get funding to extend the road up through the site that provided greater access. The remedial trust, or the settling the defendants supported reuse, they were very much interested in increasing land value that would yield them a greater return and offsetting their cleanup costs. They also approved loans with the custodial trust, for example, funding the preliminary design for the interchange. Over here let me get my little arrow up. So this is I-93 here going from north to south, and this is the new interchange that was constructed into the site. It provided direct access to the Regional Transportation Center, and this portion in the middle in between is where Commerce Way Extension was implemented by the town. That created greater access and higher value for Parcel A, which became Target Stores, and Parcel B, which is where Metro North ended up constructing Raytheon headquarters and the Marriott, the Residence Inn Marriott, is among other developments. Very successful. You can see the highlights over here that there were over 4,300 jobs created, significant increase in tax rolls to the town, the municipality. Very, very successful. And moving forward here with that success and how it all happened, we had innovative institutional controls that required us to preserve the remedy, but also provided greatest use and enjoyment of the site where possible. EPA and the state led institutional control design outline with the parties in 95-96. That led to a final design in 2005 that EPA released, and you can get a copy of that institutional controls design here in 2005, and here are also three other links to institutional controls that have been recorded at the site. So what's innovative about our institutional controls was that it was identified what the restrictions were clearly, and we had four classes of land, Class A through Class D, where Class A was least restrictive and Class D is the most restrictive. So Class A actually represents a lot of the property along I-93. That would be potential groundwater contamination. Class B is in the lighter green, which are potential groundwater, potential soil contamination. The tan highlighted area is Class C area, where there's a contaminated soils and a protective cap that has to be maintained. And Class D is the most restrictive, where there's contaminated soils and you have animal hides that should not be disturbed and avoid causing releases of odors back into the community. So here were the four hide piles again, the west east hide pile, east central hide pile, and the south hide pile. So how we came up with innovative controls was to establish how to actually penetrate a protective cover, how you could potentially modify a protective cover that was installed at the site. So we outlined in the institutional controls design a work protocol that allowed landowners to hire independent professionals to prepare the work. They would prepare work plans, health and safety plans, completion reports that explained how they were going to potentially penetrate a protective cover, manage contaminated soils, contaminated groundwater safely, and dispose of them off-site, and then reinstate the cover that either was originally constructed or could be a completely new modified design cover that the agency approves. So there's a step process for doing all that, and generally this is the same step process that's been in effect for 20 years and has been used to oversee all the reuse activities at the site since 1997. Another interesting part of this is that we have worked very well with the municipality. The municipality has taken all these classes of land and they've recorded them in their own GIS engineering mapping program so that the town is fully aware of all these classes of land. And they need to be because their roads run through the lands and their roads actually may serve as protective covers in some areas, and they need to keep their workers protected as well. So we have a very good relationship with the municipality and institutional controls and making sure the work is done protectively. So there are other obligations. Landowners have there are institutional controls that are being recorded for each and every property, and each landowner has responsibilities for maintaining their protective covers, conducting annual inspections, notifying the governments if there's a failure, and preparing plans to correct the failure. They also have an obligation to notify the governments if they see any other violations occurring at the site. And the this last bullet over here is an important one, where the landowners, if they are going to be requesting some type of permit from local, state, or federal government, they are obligated to provide them a copy of the institutional controls for their property. And if they are going to be submitting any building permits to the town, that they are obligated to provide the government's a copy of those building permits. That's important information for us as far as the communication on upcoming intrusive activities that may be coming, may be occurring in the near future on a property. There are emergency excavation requirements that basically temporarily suspend the institutional controls to allow for the emergency excavation. Ultimately, it does require the cap to be reinstated, and there's details for that in the institutional controls design. Something that is also important with institutional controls is that the property owners, each and every property owner out of this site, understands what the remedy is implemented on their property, where it is visually implemented on their property, and so that that property owner or a future property owner understands the obligations of maintaining their cover, as well as if they ever plan on conducting some type of reuse, how they can either reinstate that cover or develop similar detailed drawings to modify a cover. So this is just an example of cover certification reports that have been prepared for each property at the Industriplex Superfund site. There's a this, I'm going to go back just quickly two slides here. This map right here is actually an interactive map that you can get to the web page. That interactive map can lead any interested party to find out what specific cover is constructed on a particular property. And this is an example of if somebody were to hit one of the double click on one of these red boxes here, then this map would show up for this particular property. You could do it for a different property as well. You could come over here and you could double click on this red box, and that would also pull up the certification report for this particular property. But what we're going to do is just show you this interactive map that the governments have set up. Someone can double click on a particular property they're interested in, like this one. And if you want to get that interactive map, you can connect here to this link. The details of the property will come up. This will generally show you where there is an engineered cover in gray and where there is an equivalent cover everywhere else, which would be in the, you know, the white area, the building that's here, that's foundation, and this parking lot area that's on the side. And it has all these, you can't see this, but these are detailed points telling you what the horizontal and vertical elevation are of each cap. And a surveyor can locate any of these areas out on that particular property. And then you can get into the specific details of what exactly are in these caps. So again, this little pink area in here is actually building equivalent cover. Over on this red area here, you can see that it's a engineered asphalt cover, so they actually constructed an asphalt cover there. Another in the background back here, it's a gravel cover that surrounds the back end of the building. And then in those reports, there are cross sections that show you exactly how deep that cover is supposed to be and what it looks like. So
Joe,
those
you have
would,
1 minute left.
Okay, so that would be what would be required for a cover. And really, this all goes to, again, transforming Industrialplex into a thriving economic success story. Before and after shots, transportation center, Target stores, Raytheon headquarters, Residence Inn. And then there are other things that we've done. The remedy contamination has extended, and we're going to be expanding the site boundaries. And through mitigation efforts, we've actually mitigated a floodplain and provided a town a nature trail and walking paths. So we've actually incorporated this into a second portion of cleanup for the Industrialplex site. And in the walking trails, we've actually set up educational wetland stations explaining various types of wetlands. And so reuse is what we try to do at all our sites if we can. And some of the highlighted region sites, you can actually connect onto this link here, and it will give you Region 1 success stories on Superfund at work in communities in Region 1. And that's all I have for you. And here's my contact information.
Great. Thank you so much, Joe. That was fascinating. Next up, we'll hear from Helen Botcher from EPA Region 10 and Perry Barrett from the Bainbridge Island Metro Park and Recreation District.
All right, audio check. This is Helen, and I'm on my headset. Can everyone hear me okay?
We hear you great.
Great, thank you. All right, well, thanks so much for joining us, everyone. I am happy to present the Wyckoff Eagle Harbor Superfund site and have Perry Barrett from Bainbridge Island Metro Parks join me for this presentation. I think this will be a nice contrast to Joe's talk. It's a very different type of reuse. This site's going to be reused as a community park. So this is an aerial photo of the site, and I want to point out this sort of U shape to the site and this metal wall around the outside, because we've got a number of pictures of the site. And if you keep that U shape in mind, that will be helpful, keep us on track. Okay, so I'm going to talk real briefly and introduce the site today, kind of go over this first bullet, and then hand it over to Perry to talk in more detail about the reuse planning process that was used here at the Wyckoff site and also some of the outcomes. And then I'm going to come back and talk about lessons learned and additional cleanup action that we're planning. This is an interesting site because it's a large part of the site has already been redeveloped and is in use today as a park, and yet we still have some more cleanup actions that we need to take, and we're continuing to work on reuse planning for that next phase. This site is located on Bainbridge Island. That's an island in central Puget Sound. It's about a 30-minute ferry ride due west of Seattle. And before I launch into too much site history, I wanted to mention that for tens of thousands of years prior to European contact, this area was used by Native Americans, and the people that we today call the Suquamish tribe used Eagle Harbor as a summer village. They would gather on the shores of Eagle Harbor and catch fish and process fish, and these are salmon drying on the racks here in preparation for winter. The Suquamish tribe is a key partner for EPA and has been closely involved in the cleanup for more than 30 years now. So the site has been around for quite a while. It was added to the Superfund list in 1987. And during the initial investigation, EPA found extensive contamination in the upland soils and in the groundwater. And that contamination, unfortunately, also extended out into Eagle Harbor itself. The sediments of Eagle Harbor were very heavily contaminated with creosote and other chemicals from wood treating operations. So EPA has taken a number of cleanup actions starting in 1993 through 2008, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about those. So here's just a site overview. This is the whole harbor of Eagle Harbor. This is that U-shaped property that I pointed out on the first slide, and this is the primary area that I'm going to be talking about because this is the main area that's been turned into a park. but the whole harbor was contaminated, and there were cleanup actions over here as well as here at the former wood treating site. So this area, if you can see, I can't see the gray. Here it is. This area here. Gina, I can't grab the green arrow. Oh, that's okay. So hopefully you can see that U-shape parcel that looks very barren. Barren, that is the part of the site that we're still working to clean up. So the site was a wood treating site. They made railroad ties and creosote treated wood stave pipe, utility poles, pier pilings, decking material for the marine environment. They began operation in the early 1900s, and they treated wood on site using both creosote and pentachlorophenol. And I like to show this sort of overview site of, or photo of the site from the mid-1940s, just so you can see how extensive the operations were. These are very large tanks down here along this eastern shoreline of the site. And here's that U shape that we've been pointing out previously. This is the area that we refer to as the East Beach. And then the site wraps around here to the north, and then the West Beach is over here is the West Beach. So to date, we've done a lot of cleanup already. That earlier photo that I showed you, all those buildings are gone. Those chemical storage tanks are gone. We removed a lot of the grossly contaminated surface soils. We built that metal perimeter wall around the site that you saw in the very first slide. We built a groundwater extraction and treatment system. That's a network of groundwater wells that are used to extract groundwater, and that's treated in an on-site groundwater treatment plant before being discharged to the Puget Sound. And we also have fencing around the upland area to keep people out of that area. The soil, surface soils are still contaminated. And a lot of community outreach just to keep people appraised of continuing contamination on some of the beaches. So current site conditions, like I just mentioned, all those buildings are gone. And you can see here's our metal wall that goes around the outside of the site. That metal wall is very deep. It goes down 80 or 90 feet below the ground, and it ties into a confining layer or an aquitard. That's preventing the contamination that's left inside the middle of the site here from going out into the harbor or down into the groundwater. And that's really important for this project because the groundwater is a source of drinking water, the only source of drinking water for people who live on the island. And one other feature I was going to point out, this green metal building here, that's our groundwater treatment plant. So all the water that's extracted from this portion of the site over here gets treated here prior to discharge. So in the offshore, we've also done a lot of cleanup work, and that mostly took the form of a cap, a thick sediment cap. So we have more than 70 acres of Eagle Harbor that have been capped with sand. And that capping happened in a couple phases. So here is the harbor. All the areas that are outlined here, this blue area, red, yellow, orange, those are all just different phases of the capping effort. So to date, more than 70 acres have been capped. And I'm going to point out this area here, particularly this area that's in orange, because that's of what we call the exposure barrier system, or the cap that we built on West Beach, and that is part of the park. So this is what that West Beach shoreline used to look like. Before we did the cleanup, you could see this old wooden bulkhead. There were a lot of contaminated soils, soils that were saturated with wood treating chemicals behind this bulkhead, and that liquid contamination was leaking out through the bulkhead and contaminating this very narrow little stretch of beach. So all that got removed, and that shoreline laid back and a natural beach installed. And I have a picture to show you what that beach looks like today. There's the beach today, and it is a very popular amenity in the local community. I love this picture. This little kid, Perry, sent this over to me. But I've never been on the site when I haven't seen people out on this beach. This was a close coordination between EPA and parks to decide really what that final beach surface should look like. And it's a nice beach. It also provides great habitat. There's a lot of fish that spawn in the beach, and we find clams and crabs and all kinds of things living out there. So redevelopment actions to date. A good part of the property has already been turned into a park, and the EPA sold the property to the City of Bainbridge Island and Bainbridge Island Metro Parks in the early 2000s, and they developed a series of trails, hiking trails down through the woods above the beach, and then, of course, the beach itself, which I just showed you. And then there's also a memorial on the western end of the park that I'm going to let Perry talk about a little bit more. So that's just a quick introduction to the cleanup actions, and I'd like to turn it over to Perry and let him talk about the reuse and the redevelopment. But before we do that, does anyone have any questions on the cleanup actions? Okay, well, hearing none, I want to go ahead and introduce Perry Barrett then, my co-presenter. Perry is a senior planner with Bainbridge Island Metro Parks.
Thank
Perry,
you, Helen.
Take it away.
Yeah, thank you, Helen. Dovetailing with Helen with regard to park development, some of the transition elements that were important to the community. In 1994, the PSR Trust had been set up to manage the site's bankruptcy assets. And in 1996 through 1998, there was the Wyckoff Task Force. This was a city committee conducting a review of zoning on the property. Additionally, at that time, the National Park Service completed its historic American engineering record, work lending significance to the Taylor Road end adjacent to the site on the west side. And then locally also, the Bainbridge Island World War II Nike Internment and Exclusion Memorial Committee was established. And their title and mission statement, Nadato Na Nioni, which translates, let it not happen again. And if Helen, I seem to have lost my slide. So if you could help me out with a slide change, that would be great right there. Thank you. Just one there. All right. The site, beginning in 2002, there was an acquisition task force, and the 2002 EPA pilot project also occurred. And this pilot project was fostered by the UW Landscape Studio effort from the University of Washington. And these two efforts combined to host the exploration of the site, its current conditions, and significance of the site's cultural history on the site. So all this was important in terms of defining what might be, I'm going to move this, see if I can control. Yes, thank you. Helen, I've got it. Thanks. All this combines to the reuse design framework, and that's site design and program opportunities. The study revealed the program of ecological, recreation, and historic offerings, and offered up a rich and regenerative landscape for the former industrial site. Regeneration begins with identifying the naming of places through their history, activity, and their experiential qualities. And so you see that with defining first the memorial area that we have here, the regeneration in the middle, and interpretation and remediation at the eastern side of the site. And in Washington, D.C., Jay Inslee was then our local representative. He introduced members of the Memorial Committee to the congressional committees, resulting in the passage of the Bainbridge Island Japanese American Monument Act. In 2003 above, the site begins to impress local residents, long ago fenced off from the public's view, a site left over, abandoned from creosote manufacturing era. Partnerships at this time begin to coalesce. The Friends of Pritchard Park is formed. The City of Bainbridge Island Council endorses the selection of Pritchard Park as the park's name, and the Trust for Public Land enters into an agreement to acquire the property for $8 million. The city agrees to purchase the land from TPL as a successor. And in tandem, EPA, Department of Ecology, and the city sign a prospective purchaser agreement, and this describes the future land use, which is a future park, as mitigation and institutional controls attached to the agreed order and Justice Department covenant. In 2004, purchase actually begins and concludes in 2006 in various phases. And in 2007, the Pritchard Park Design Advisory Committee begins its work with assistance from the UW Graduate School Built Form. From the EPA pilot study, the site planning was further broken down to provide greater access, park activity, beach access, in addition to identification of the memorial area, viewpoints, and trails. The site's interpretation describing Native American site connection, Creosote town area, as well as World War II internment era, would be explored in gathering areas and nodes known as pearls. Once the site was available to the public by 2007, only the point remained off limits, or 8.5 acres of the 50-acre site. Citizens could enjoy a combination of views from its eastern slope, views of Seattle, Cascades, and Mount Rainier, to its western beach, as shown above, of Eagle Harbor and the Olympics. On the planning process conducted in the 2007 to 2008 period, longtime advocate Charles Schmidt comments on, quote, the creativity brought by the students, unquote. That's the University of Washington's Graduate School of Design and Urban Planning. The process resulted in the report that synthesized the site's history, features, cleanup considerations, and laid out a series of design recommendations. The resulting report further documented the community's future use goals for the site, a valuable resource for EPA and ecology as they continue to work on integrating the remedy and reuse considerations. And as the co-chair of the design committee, Barb Trafton, said, quote, we have a lovely beach now. It makes me feel really good that people are using this facility. And a quote from the design, or from the citizens committee as a whole, quote, the park represents the opportunity for healing and restoration of two wrongs from the past, one to the social fabric of the community and to the other, the land itself. We feel that our final design acknowledges these complexities and looks ahead to the future of this place. And since 2008, a series of upland trails were built or gradually reclaimed from the years of abandonment, resulting in the accumulation of invasive species that threaten the tree canopy. We use the volunteers, we have nonprofits such as Weed Warriors, and we mobilized on a regular basis with community efforts such as Earth Day. These volunteer efforts help to reconnect the interface between the shoreline and the upland forest canopy, a rare and desirable backdrop of forested island, with its shoreline which its shoreline is over 90% in private ownership and publicly off limits. Today, school groups tour the memorial, dogs and their owners play on the West Beach, hikers enjoy the Pritchard Park trails and views. Over time, interacting with the site as a park rather than a contaminated property has changed public perceptions. Quote, I call it Pritchard now instead of Wyckoff, says Barb Trafton. It's very much Pritchard now in many of our minds, unquote. At the memorial itself, the time was never better than to begin telling the nation's story and use of internment. The story involved on March 30th, 1942, the federal government, through Executive Order 9066, gave authority to the War Department to remove what would be a total of over 110,000 persons of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast. The first of these are 227 residents from Bainbridge Island. In 2007, Congress passed a bill making the memorial an extension of the Minidoka Internment National Monument in Idaho. the location of where Bainbridge Island residents spent much of their time in incarceration. President Bush signed the bill into law in 2008. And here, site design of the memorial was developed in phases and led by John Paul Jones of Jones & Jones here in Seattle. Above, the use of a green roof and sustainability elements reflect components called for in Pritchard Park Plan. And the memorial, quote, does more to tell a story, does not tell a story about blame, guilt, or shame. It tells a story about hope. And this is from Clarence Morawaki, the president of BIJAMA, which is our nonprofit affiliate that works with the memorial. And the design of the wall, which is there and opened in 2011, each component of the memorial's design has an important meaning. The serpentine wooden wall is 276 feet long, 1 foot for each person taken to the internment camps from Bainbridge. And then the break in the wall symbolizes the break in people's lives caused by the exclusion and incarceration. The last part of the wall includes images and quotes related to the residents' return. Bainbridge is one of the few communities that would welcome back its prisoners and help them pick up their lives, and this is reflected in David Gooderson's Snow Falling on Cedars. And then what is the takeaway? The takeaway is we utilize site discovery. Above, Bill Point is a valuable resource because of its striking views, large acreage, extensive shoreline, prominent position, and proximity to an important site of national historic significance. Also, local leaders and community members were actively engaged from the onset of the site cleanup planning and then built partnerships and identified resources to make Pritchard Park and Memorial possible. Phasing park development and opening parts of the property to the public as soon as possible helped build community support for the project. And specifically, the site's Japanese-American exclusion history was an urgent, compelling story that needed to be told. Its importance helped raise the project's profile both locally and nationally. And then larger lessons. Know the local setting, its landscape, history, and people. Something has happened here prior to the Superfund status. Answer the what, who, and when, not just where and how. And develop the intellectual infrastructure and patience for decision makers. A plan discusses site constraints, but points the direction forward toward future opportunities. And lastly, Superfund site status will represent more than a cleanup to a community when related to the human history of place, prior and future endeavors, and seek to reinstill a sense of dignity. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Perry. So this is a work in progress. More cleanup work is needed at the site. And in 2016, EPA proposed to the public through a proposed plan additional cleanup work on the former wood treating site. So that area inside that metal U-shaped wall where the groundwater is still grossly contaminated, we're proposing a new remedy, a much more aggressive remedy to treat that contamination in place. And then on the beaches, we still have areas where there's active creosote seeps on the beaches, and those areas are closed for shellfish harvesting, and we encourage people not to walk out onto those beaches so that they don't become contaminated with a creosote. So a lot more cleanup is in the works, and we will continue to work closely with the city and with Bainbridge Island Metro Parks as the cleanup plans, the more detailed cleanup plans develop. Just one example of that, when we do the rest of the upland cleanup, we will work closely with parks to determine the best grading and management plan for that upland area, how we're going to deal with stormwater, what the final surface of the new perimeter wall is going to look like. So the community is going to continue to be closely involved as we move into this next phase of cleanup. So this is a really rich site. There's a lot of history, a lot of human history, a lot of cleanup history, and quite a bit of development work that's been done already. And so I wanted to leave you all with some resources. Perry talked briefly about this community reuse plan. There's a link here. It's a great document that will help you understand a lot more how that cleanup plan came into place, from the EPA's initial grant to involving the University of Washington, and then what the final recommendations were. And then there's other links here for if you're interested in learning more about the cleanup itself, about Pritchard Park. This site here has some great information about the Japanese American Exclusion Memorial. And finally, I would like to draw your attention to this, the last link, which is the reuse case study. There's a really nice white paper that the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative developed last year that talks about site history and redevelopment actions to date. This is just a picture looking from what is going to be the crown jewel of the park, in my view, the big open area that's currently inside that metal wall. This is what you see when you look east back to the city of Seattle. You can see that this is just a beautiful setting, and it's going to be a gorgeous park for the community for decades to come. And with that, I think we have just a few minutes for some questions.
Great. Thank you both so much. We have just a couple minutes for questions, so I think I'm just going to take one for now. Has there been any evidence of disease from the creosote exposure in nearby populations?
That's a difficult question to answer. I would say anecdotally, yes, in that we've heard community members who either themselves worked at the creosote facility or whose parents did say that they developed cancers. And they believe that that's a result of the exposure. But we don't have any, you know, it's not a big enough community to really do an epidemiological study and prove beyond doubt that that was the cause.
Great. Thank you both so much, Helen and Perry. Finally, we're going to hear from Mark Lewis with the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection and Kathy Castagna with EPA Region 1.
Hi. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kathy Castagna, and I'm with the EPA Region 1 Brownfields Program. I'm happy to present with my co-worker on my state counterpart with Mark Lewis from the Connecticut DEEP, and what we'll be presenting on today is the prepared workbook. So what I would like to do is just give you a little bit of context about the prepared process and what EPA did to develop this workbook. Our many contaminated properties, in our view, would simply not be redeveloped without municipal involvement, and these can range from Superfund sites, which we've seen some excellent examples today, to actually small brownfields corner gas stations or small vacant or abandoned factories. So these properties often involve complex environmental issues. The municipalities need to understand and address these issues to avoid taking on unacceptable financial and legal risk. Deciding whether and how to move a project forward in a community can be a very difficult challenge for municipal officials. The prepared workbook was developed by EPA Region 1 in 2011 with the Land Revitalization Program and the Brownfields Program. And it was the main thrust of the workbook is to address concerns on the municipality's part on how they may intersect with the redevelopment of a contaminated property. The workbook itself covers a wide array of technical and regulatory topics and provides a framework for assessing and managing risk. If you can see on the left-hand side of the screen is the cover of the workbook, and we provide links for that later on. And the right-hand side of the screen is the actual prepared process that was developed by our team. We also had help from one of our contractors in the Superfund Land Revitalization Program. Avita Nova was instrumental in helping us develop this concept of risk management for acquiring properties. So the workbook itself is, as I said, very comprehensive. It's over 200 pages. And although that sounds intimidating, it's not expected that every municipal official would be an expert in every aspect of this workbook, but it's more important as a tool for general familiarity so that the municipal officials will have an understanding of the process and the issues that they have to face before they go ahead and decide to intervene in any kind of property acquisition action to promote redevelopment of these either Superfund sites or, as I said, brownfield sites. So the workbook is intended to be a resource that a municipal official can turn to as needed for a particular site or project. Incorporated in the workbook are worksheets that correlate to the 8 steps that we've outlined on the right-hand side of the slide, which is, I'm going to go through these in a second. So the actual workbook itself has worksheets, and it allows for an iterative process of deciding, documenting information about sites, deciding on what might be good, useful reuse strategies for sites, and communicating with stakeholders on how the process evolves, and really providing a documentation for future decision makers as things go along. Many of these sites take many, many years to redevelop. So let me just walk you through the first establishing goals. So basically, this is a planning tool. So the key considerations are, what's the desired outcome for the site? How important to the community is the reuse? What's the time-critical nature of redeveloping this site? Are there real or known constraints to developing the site? And any pre-existing biases that the community has about the site? And as you see in all of these graphics, stakeholder engagement is key to the process of having a successful redevelopment. We identify, after we go through establishing goals, we help the communities through the workbook process and the worksheets provide, gather information for a preliminary reuse assessment. And that information could be it will be the status of the property, the physical and social opportunities and constraints of the property, community needs and potential impacts, market and market demands, general cost constraints, and again, potential for success and level of risk. One of the main reasons why the Region 1 developed this workbook, we had a set of stakeholder meetings with municipalities throughout New England, and we talked about, you know, very frankly, what are the concerns municipalities have in acquiring contaminated properties. And it really was that there's various levels of understanding on the complexities of the legal issues, the environmental issues, the financial constraints, and the community concerns. So by putting together this whole process, we're really just walking people through how one would deal with redeveloping a contaminated property if you were a municipal official. And again, in New England, we really have a town meeting type of government throughout our 6 New England states, so it's a very much community-driven process for communities to make decisions on acquiring property and redeveloping property. So the second step in the process is the third step of the process is identifying the property recovery actions that a municipality might take. And we've identified, you know, if you want to go through a process of less liability, you might be looking at tax liens or promotion incentives to promote reuse, or collaborating with the property owner. If you want more control of the property, the municipality may want to think about acquisition and or leasing or some sort of transfer to a third party. But there's many options that we lay out for the municipal officials to consider as they are going through their decision-making process. Let's get the next one in here. Okay, so the fourth process is conducting due diligence, and obviously that's, you know, the key element in environmental investigation, assessment, and cleanup is the due diligence process. So we put all the information out there for what has to be done to conduct the due diligence for a property, and that allows the municipality to understand the potential impediments to reuse and cost issues about environmental cleanup. Okay, Another of our steps is identifying property reuse obstacles. And again, there's economic limitations, legal challenges, regulatory hurdles, community concerns, development issues, management considerations. And we provide an iterative process where the municipality can be documenting through this prepared process how they would be addressing these obstacles and which obstacles would be insurmountable versus ones that they can mitigate through their own planning process. And then we ask in the process to assess the property reuse risks. And again, legal, financial, and community risks are key and paramount in this process. And risk really refers to the probability that an adverse event will occur and the circumstances or the consequences of that event. So it's really a risk-based framework to look at what level of risk the municipality is comfortable with in the acquisition process. And in doing so, there's opportunities to identify risk management options. Risk can always be eliminated in this situation, but sometimes they can be mitigated or managed. And then finally, as you go around the circle, there's an opportunity to have stakeholder engagement, and then data gaps can be filled in. But at the end of the process, there should be some sort of understanding of what property recovery action the municipality wants to take. And that can be anything from leasing the property, transferring tax liens, providing incentives for reuse, could be actual acquisition, it could be acquisition and transfer to a third party, it could be a total red flag where the municipality decides in the end that they don't want to take any direct action on the property, that they'll let the market do what it has to do. But it really allows the municipality, because there's many, many stakeholders involved in this process and it takes many years to develop brownfields and Superfund sites, it allows for this documentation of the major decision on the project, and it allows for transparency and clarity and communication with the public as far as having everything in one process. Okay, and so what I'm going to do now is turn it over to my colleague Mark Lewis, because what we did was we worked directly with the New England states in preparing this book, but the most important part was when we worked with Connecticut DEEP to web-enable this process, and Mark's going to give us a live demonstration of that. So Mark, I'll take it away.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. And again, this is Mark Lewis with the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. And as Kathy said, we worked closely with EPA Region 1 to develop the first state-specific version of the prepared workbook. And it was intended to be a pilot program. We hope that other states will follow this example. And I would be very, very willing to work with any other state that might be listening today to do this. Found it to be a very valuable exercise in just looking at how our cleanup programs all work and really putting them down on paper. It also gave me a really healthy respect for the people that do web programming. One of the things that I wanted to say is that this is a series of forms that are mostly in Microsoft Word. One is in Microsoft Excel. And these are not meant to be more forms that you have to fill out. They're meant to be a planning tool that is used by the municipality to document their decisions about a site. And overall, it's meant to be a guided tour to the very complicated process of redeveloping brownfields and contaminated properties. With that, I am ready to do the live demo. So if we could share my screen.
Okay, and so Mark, you can go ahead and share your screen. I'll confirm once we're able to see everything. Just a reminder for those watching online, if you need to make Mark's screen bigger, you can click that four-arrowed button in the larger. Why don't you click restart later, Mark? That's probably the right thing. And we'll just restart later and restart later, and then hopefully we can browse over to a website and you can open up the workbook.
Hopefully.
As noted,
I have it up already.
There we go. All right, so Mark, I'm just confirming you can see everything on your screen.
When you go to this, and there's a link provided to this, you will land on the prepared workbook portion of the DEEP's website. And if you can't find it, you can always either email me or just go to our website and use the search function to find prepared. You will land here on this diagram that looks very much like the diagram that Kathy presented. And you can go to any one of these circles. These are all live, and it starts off at the beginning with establishing goals, and I'll just demonstrate with establishing goals. This will bring you to a series of instructions that talk you through that portion of the prepared process. You can also navigate to the next section by clicking here. The next section is property reuse. And you can also go to the worksheets. I mentioned that there are both Microsoft Word worksheets and there's one Microsoft Excel. This enables you to download them. And there are instructions and there are the actual worksheets. We'll go ahead and open the worksheet. It'll take a second to download from our somewhat slow website. But I will point out that all of these worksheets, whether they are in Word or Excel, are unlocked. And they are unlocked on purpose so that you can alter them as fits your situation. And again, you don't need to fill all of these out. And at the bottom of most of them, there is a place to put down your name and your contact information. This is not meant, again, to be something that you have to do. It's meant so that you know at this date, in May 2017, these are the people that worked on the project, and these are the thoughts you had. And it's particularly useful for complicated projects that take a long time to get cleaned up so that when you have turnover in your team, it's a good communication tool for letting new people on the team know what is happening on your site. And that's really all I have in showing a test drive of the state-specific prepared process. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, we'll turn off that screen sharing and we'll go back to the presentation deck. And let me turn back to Erica and see where we are on time.
We have a few minutes left if there's anything else you guys have to share with us. No? All right, great. Well, thank you all. Thank you to Joe, Helen, Perry, Mark, and Kathy. It was really great to hear about all the successful public service-related redevelopment Superfund sites, and especially the lessons learned on how EPA and local municipalities can work together to make reuse happen. It was also really great to hear about the prepared workbook as a tool to assist local governments with Superfund property acquisitions. To everyone that's tuned in, I hope the presenter's discussion today has expanded your knowledge of both the challenges and the possibilities of Superfund sites with public service projects. Showcasing these successful reuse projects is a really important part of what we do here at SRI. We've found that sharing these case studies and lessons learned is a very impactful tool for promoting safe and beneficial reuse. And stories like the ones we heard today allow us to demonstrate how resources can be used effectively and provide inspiration for those looking to reuse contaminated properties. So by sharing the story of public services reuse, our presenters have contributed to continued Superfund reuse. So again, thank you to you all. I'd like to wrap up our time today by providing some resources, and then we'll use our remaining time for any additional questions and a survey. So on the next slide, you can see, and if everyone could put their phones on mute, that would be great. So as I mentioned at the beginning of our time today, SRI has a number of tools and resources available on our website to help you consider reuse at your Superfund site. The SRI website is included as a link in the additional resources on the right side of your Adobe Connect screen. SRI also has a redevelopment coordinator in each region to support reuse at the site-specific level. So if you want any more information about an existing reuse project or would like to discuss potential reuse opportunities at mining sites or any site near you, please reach out to these folks. They are our experts. You, of course, also can reach out to Melissa Friedland and Frank Avisado. whose information is on this last screen here. So I'd like to, at this point, pause for a few minutes to answer any questions that we have, or answer some questions that have been coming in. While I do so, we're going to switch the screen view over to the survey screen. We'd really appreciate it if you take a minute to fill the survey out, let us know what future webinar topics you would benefit from, and add your email address at the bottom left if you would like to be on our notification list for future webinars. So please do thank you for those that are already doing so. That is great. Thank you very much. So we're going to go through a few questions here. So first question, this is for Mark and Kathy. Has anyone ever generated a database that would allow you to assign projects associated with specific location and track progress? So pass that to you, Mark and Kathy. You may need to unmute. Okay.
This is Mark. We have not done that within the context of the prepared workbook. However, we do have a brownfields inventory, which is probably as close as we're going to come to such a database, and that brownfields inventory is actually on our website, and I can, if you can't find that through the search engine on our website, I'd be happy to provide the location of that to anybody, and it lists the name, address, and the municipality in which all of our brownfield sites are located.
And Mark,
go ahead.
Sorry, this is Kathy from the EPA regional office. Each grant recipient for community-wide assessment grants, many there's an opportunity within that grant funding schedule to prepare brownfields inventories for their communities as they're working on developing their brownfields program and choosing sites. So many of the municipalities themselves have developed inventories, and as Mark said, some of the states have done their own inventory process, but it isn't really part and parcel of the prepared scenario, if you will.
Great. And Mark, were you referring to the BIT tool?
No, this is a state-specific brownfields inventory, which we maintain, and we try to update it once a year. It's a fairly simple inventory. We maintain it in an Excel spreadsheet format.
Okay, great. Another question we have here for Helen and Perry. So what has been the biggest challenge for site reuse, and what advice do you have for other stakeholders trying to bring a public reuse to a site? So that's for Helen and Perry.
Helen, do you want to take a stab at that, or should I talk that? It sounds like Helen is not on the call just yet. I think the largest challenge for us on the site was just recognizing the site first. The site had been basically laid, you know, in non-use for such a time, so that the idea of converting it to a public use, the public really had to have access to the site and explore the site. So we needed to first elicit creativity through, you know, more and more exposure of the site and ways that we could enter the site and explore the site with members of the public and stakeholders. And that took a succession of studies and, you know, actually working with the UW, University of Washington, twice. The pilot study helped originally suggest different ideas, and then the community kind of took off from there in terms of public reuse and how it would come together. The cost of acquisition was at first a barrier, but then different grants came along as well, too. So that was a secondary concern, not first.
And this is Helen. The only other thing I would add is that I think it's the timeline is challenging for communities. Superfund is not a quick process, and this site in particular is a really challenging, technically challenging site that's taken a very long time to clean up, and we're still not done. And so sort of maintaining that sustained interest and commitment from the community, it's tough. We need people that are willing to be in it for the long run in order to pull this all off.
Great. Thank you both. And I should point out that Joe had to leave us a little bit early, so I know some folks had questions for him, but he had to leave us. So one last question we have time for, and this is for Kathy and Mark again. So what recommendations would you have for a community or a municipality that wants to work with the State Environmental Protection Agency or the EPA to reuse a contaminated site, and how would they get the process started?
Well, this is Kathy, and I would say, you know, it's a perfect question on the prepared workbook, because what I would recommend is to start looking at the prepared workbook and looking at the process that we've laid out in that workbook, and engaging partnerships with the EPA regional office and engaging with partnerships in the state where you're at. If you happen to be in Connecticut, you can actually go on the website, as Mark showed, and actually begin to start the process and educate yourself on the process of what aspects are important and critical to a community in making these decisions and staying with the decision all the way through. So I think that the prepared workbook itself lays out a process, and I think the web-enabled Connecticut project, even if you're not in Connecticut, you can get on that website and really play around with the steps that we've laid out, play around with the web worksheets, and it also links back to the EPA prepared workbook. And so I think that education in how to do that and understanding all the variables that are important to address is probably the first important step you could take.
Great. Yeah, Thank you. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
This is Mark. I would just say something that Kathy said I think is key is partnership. I would say the biggest thing is just communication. Just if you are a municipality or a private developer that's thinking of reusing a property or looking at the best way to do so, pick up the phone, and if you're in Connecticut, call me and speak to Kathy or whoever your person is at Region 1. We are very happy to work with people, and the earlier that partnership starts, the better and the more successful the project is going to be.
Great. Thank you both so much. We're a little over time, so I'm going to thank you all again to all our presenters and pass the mic back to Jean.
Okay, thank you so very much. Let me walk through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. A number of you have asked if copies of the material or some of the links that were discussed can be accessed, and I just wanted to remind everybody the materials are currently available to download from the seminar homepage. You have also asked if this material will be available later on, and the answer is yes. We did record today's broadcast, and we will archive it along with the over 30 previously recorded Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinars that we have up on the CLUIN website. And then we have over 600 webinars on other topics, which you're also welcome to browse through if you like. I'm going to move past this one and just again remind everybody that those materials can be found on the seminar homepage. If you go back to the same information that you used to join us for today's live broadcast, there are tabs along the top of that page, one for the presenter so you can find contact information, another for the slides and related resources so you can click through those materials and download them. And you can also follow a link to share feedback for today's live broadcast. One of the biggest questions we get is if you can get a participation certificate, and we do have those available. So once you fill out the online feedback form, there's a box you can check to confirm you were here for the whole session. Once you check that box and send in your feedback, you'll have immediate access to a participation certificate that you can download or save for your own records. If you happen to participate in a group of individuals, each person can fill out that feedback form to get their own certificate. And then if you happen to be one of those lucky ones replaying the archived version today, you can still follow those links and access the recorded version to complete your feedback. With that, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us. We had over 170 individuals from all over the U.S. for today's live broadcast. I want to thank all of the instructors as well.